Welcome, listeners, to the last of our official coverage or film coverage episodes here at Feelin' Film. I'm Patch, one of your co-hosts, and with me, ready to hunt down some great conversation, one clue at a time, is my best friend and co-host, Aaron.
Sic parvis magna, Patrick.
That's right. My son was like, why is he sick when we were watching this? No. It's a different language, sir. You got to embrace the Latin. I think it's Latin, right? Would that be Latin?
It's definitely Latin. And okay. The Uncharted vibes grow throughout the course of watching one through two to the point where it was very difficult not to just fire up the games again because it's my favorite video game series. And man, I always forget how much the end of National Treasure 2 feels like one of those games. Minus the machine gun fire. Sorry.
Well, sure.
But close.
Yeah. It's a Disney Uncharted movie is what it is. I almost wonder if Naughty Dog would take a National Treasure 3 approach to a video game. Like, how cool would that be to have our page 47 in a game? Like, that kind of discovery. I think that would be kind of cool. I mean, just go on full adventure treasure hunt, you know, take your Nathan Drake and just put Ben Gates in there and make it happen. Again, the gunfire stuff is probably going to have to get amped up a little bit, you know, but I just, we have two, we were almost promised three. It's still sort of being talked about, but I seriously doubt it after almost 10 years since the second movie came out, but I digress.
Did you watch the show that came out?
I didn't.
Okay. Yeah, I asked my roommate. I did not. He watched it. My roommate did. And I asked him today, I said, did you like it? And he said, I liked it enough to finish it and not bail on it and finish it because I wanted to see it and not just to be a completionist. And I was like, well, that seems like a one thumb up positive review. Like he liked it enough, right? But he definitely he wasn't blown away by it or anything like that.
Yeah.
So I don't feel like it's something I want to go see. Frankly, even just rewatching these, I start to think about all of the legacy sequels we've gotten that don't really work very well. Mm-hmm. How rare it is to get like a Top Gun Maverick. And I think I'm good. I do. I think I'm good.
Yeah, I think I'm in that same camp. Again, I miss the adventure. I am going to always wonder what's on page 47. And that's why I mentioned a game format. Like, let's play it. Let's really do that. But because, again, you can retroactively, you don't have to age these characters. They can just be, you know, a couple of years after the second movie. You don't have to worry about it. And you get their great voices. And I think that seems to be the best way to go, or a comic book or animation, animated series or animated movie. But in any case, I think the two National Treasure movies are interesting because as I watched them back to back for this episode, I didn't realize how different they were. Like, there's definitely a through line with the characters and it's a treasure hunt and, you know, we'll get into all that, but it's really interesting to see the different approaches that the two movies take when it comes to these types of treasure hunting movies. Like, you would think, oh, it's a sequel, so yeah, we're going to get the same beats, and we sort of do, but I'm kind of impressed with the approach that the second movie takes as a different way from the first movie. It really is treasure hunt, heist, and then full on treasure hunt. Like, that's kind of what the flavor I got. I got heist movie, and then I got full treasure hunt. And I think it had to do with a lot of things that we'll talk about, but they're both great in their own right. I think it's a great pairing. It's just a great double feature that you'd want to get into. And I'm glad we're doing this. I'm glad we're really kind of tackling both at the same time. So let's get into it with authority. This is your official spoiler warning. We're actually, you know, if you've tuned in, you know, we're covering both National Treasure and National Treasure Book of Secrets. We chose this because we are obviously, we love sports movies, and we unintentionally picked three for our final five. And the last two were part of our second favorite, maybe 1A when it comes to our favorite movie genre. And that's the heist / treasure hunt, mostly heists. But, in fact, just a little inside baseball. Before we decided to sunset the show, our 400th episode was actually going to be three heist movies. And so, you know, we'll end up watching them. Don't know if we'll talk about them, but definitely we wanted to finish out this official podcast on a high note. And what better way than these two movies? All right. So, spoiler warning for everything. You said it. Here we go. We are in these two movies, Aaron, and I'm looking at kind of how do we approach this? How do we look at these two movies? And I almost wanted to create a game out of it and like see who won the movie when it comes to these different points. So maybe we'll get into that. It's not official, but I wanted to talk about some of the things that make these movies so great. And I want to start out by really kind of looking at the treasure itself. So in your opinion, National Treasure, Book of Secrets, they're going after two different treasures. Which one for you is your favorite to go after?
Easily the first movie. I think they're very different in terms of the feeling of the films, like you specifically pointed out there, where the first movie is very strictly based on the heist formula for stealing the Declaration of Independence. Like, that is such a big part of the film, and the replication of that and is a little bit less exciting when it's cool that there's these two different desks in two different parts of the world, but it's not the Declaration of Independence. Like, there's something that's built up to, and even after they get it, it's just this idea of, it's not like that's the heist part of it, right? The treasure part is after that. And for me, I didn't feel there's as much of a heist element to the second movie. But that being said, the second movie for me feels very much in like conversation with the film franchises as they were going at that time. And so I looked this up because I was wondering, and I should have wrote down what years the two National Treasure movies were. I want to say like 2000-ish and like 2006 or something like that. Do you know off the top of your head? Probably not.
Of when these came out? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, so this was, so National Treasure was 04 and Book of Secrets was 07.
Okay, so 04 was, I can see where they went for a little bit less exciting. There's elements in there, but the ramp up comes, and I feel like that's largely because at that point we had, by the time the second movie came out, we were now up to three Mission Impossible movies. We were now knee deep into a Pirates of the Caribbean franchise that was just like riding high. We were two books into Dan Brown writing Angels and Demons and The Da Vinci Code, and those took the world by storm, had a humongous fan base, were very much similar to the National Treasure formula, only going after like religious artifacts and relics versus political and historical like ones in that way. And I just feel like the world kind of film wise, entertainment wise, really explains why the second movie was so much more fast paced. Like, the car chase is very different in the second movie.
Yeah.
I know you want to talk about specific elements, we'll get to them, but like, yeah. So for me, the heist, I think the Declaration of Independence is the iconic heist that if you want to put that up against any other heist in any other movie in this whole franchise, that's what is synonymous to me with the words National Treasure. It's stealing the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think we give that one a point for sure, because I think that when we think about National Treasure, as you said, the Declaration was the thing that was stolen, but we forget that it was leading to the treasure. Like, there's all this other stuff. And I think this is where the movies almost do opposite things. We remember the Declaration of Independence, but in reality, it was a means to an end. It was the companion piece, like the trinket that they carried all the way until they got to the actual treasure. The second movie were clue after clue after clue after clue, but we knew from the jump what the intent was. The intent was the City of Gold. Like, that's the thing. Both of them had treasure. There was buried treasure, just general like treasure, like historical treasure in the first one. And then you have the second one, which is the City of Gold. And I think you're right. I think it's the thing that you have to use to get there that makes it so memorable, because the first one had a genuine heist feel to it, where we have Ben Gates and his crew planning this whole thing. I love this part of heist movies, is the plan. Like, Ocean's 11, I think, does this really, really well as a classic. Here's how we're going to do it. you know, which we can't, you know, we can't do this, which we can't fake. I love the plan. That's always going to be a favorite part of the heist because I'm ready to see how it goes and I'm ready to see how plan B has to happen because that always happens too. And this had that, whereas Book of Secrets was really an adventure story, starting with a different kind of motive. It felt more like a treasure hunt, in my opinion, the second one did, because you were finding clue after clue that led to this, where there was not one specific piece besides the diary entry. But that sort of took a backseat to everything else. Like, I'm thinking, I almost got Indiana Jones 4 vibes because it kind of felt like it went a little too into that Uncharted realm, which I did not mind at all. But I think what makes the first one so good is that it stayed with national treasure. Everything was about the history of the United States. When we get into the City of Gold, now we're getting into non-American stuff.
I mean, non-American in the way, I know what you mean, but it's a Native American treasure. So it's very
sure,
American.
That's what I mean. Like,
it's like non-political. Like, yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because everything about the Declaration of Independence is what? Our independence from Europe. We have created our own, and granted, stealing the land from people to make that happen, notwithstanding. But yes, there is American history that lives on in how we govern ourselves. And all of that was underneath. It was the foundation by which National Treasure was built. Book of Secrets was really more about getting from one thing that led to another that sort of just kind of moved us forward. And I think what you said was really great. It got bigger. It was a bigger thing, bigger set pieces, bigger hints, bigger clues. I mean, they're going everywhere.
Yeah, whereas like the two car chases, if you look at them, are so distinctly different. I mean, the second one, in the second movie, it's more Fast and the Furious. In the first movie, it's like, you know, closer to like an 80s or 90s movie car chase.
They're running through Washington,
Right. It's not really that big of a deal. And the other one, they're like, cars are ramping up and like wrecking and you got cameras zooming in and like it's all kinds of stuff going on.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of that has to do with the motive for getting to that treasure. So we have two different things that are going on. First movie, it starts out with, again, a great opening where you've got Ian, played by Sean Bean, fantastic, who becomes the quote unquote bad guy. He's part of this original crew. They find the Charlotte, they're in the snow, and it's like, it's all this like, what's going on here? Whereas the second one is a more gradual, we're getting reintroduced to the characters, and the motive for going after the treasure is sort of usurped by or created by Mitch, who wants the treasure for himself. And it's really more about protecting a family legacy. And I think that was a really good choice, because if we got National Treasure 2 and it was the same beats, like, oh, maybe Ian's coming back. Well, that story's already been told. So I thought it was a really, really smart thing to do to not only change what's going after, but also change the motive, that there's more stakes involved, because now you've got Ben and Abigail, who are together but separate in the second movie. You've got Riley, who's written this great book that nobody reads. And you've got more with Patrick Gates, and you've got expansion with his ex-wife. All of it, I think, is appropriate, because now you've introduced new characters, but you've expanded the reason why they're doing this. And so for Ben, it's about protecting his family legacy. And for someone like Mitch, it doesn't really seem like a clear-cut bad guy. Like, I kind of understand his motives. They're not as fleshed out as I would have liked, but they're a lot more rounded than necessarily like someone like Ian, who I'm fine with him being the bad guy. I think Sean Bean plays a great bad guy, and I love how he gets faked out at the end. I think all the stuff that works in the first movie, I couldn't see that in the second one with a character like Ian, but I could with a guy like Mitch.
Yeah, so villain wise, I don't like give a point either way, because I think they both really fit their movie like you just described perfectly. The cast in general, it just astonishes me every time I rewatch these, because I don't watch them that frequently, and I'm kind of surprised all over again. You know, like Helen Mirren showing up for a cup of coffee as the angry, salty ex-wife of Patrick Gates. very much reminded me of Fast and the Furious and how she like pops into that series at the end of the series or toward the end of it as the mom, you know, of these characters we know. But for those two guys, I completely agree with you. I love that Ian's a bad guy. Okay, Ian tries to kill them. Ian shoots at them frequently. Mitch, while he is also going after a treasure, there is a distinct difference in the reasons they're going after the treasure, and you pointed this out. So it's the motivation that changes. And what I like about the Mitch character, and frankly just Ed Harris, is just Ed Harris is phenomenal, period. But like,
yes,
what he brings to that character, he brings, like, Sean Bean plays it how he has to play. He's a cookie cutter villain. Okay, he does it really well, but that's what he is. He doesn't have depth to his character. He's a betraying cookie cutter villain, video game style. Mitch also is trying to protect a family legacy. And that is what is interesting to me, and how it plays out at the end is the fact that Mitch is going about it the wrong way, the way where he hurts people in order to prove his point. But the reality is both Gates and Mitch, both Ben and Mitch, are trying to ensure that their family history is intact and that it is recognized positively in the annals of the world. Like, and I think that is really compelling. Even though Mitch is wrong, like, the thing is, I was thinking about this, you don't know. No one knows. Neither Mitch or Ben know, right? Everything they are assuming about their ancestors, other than, like, they're not like famous generals or whatever, right? So they're assuming the best intentions or the best of their particular bloodline, because, I mean, who wouldn't, right? Like, who would want to believe that my family was some awful plantation slave owners, you know, who murdered, you know, I don't want to believe that, but maybe they were. You never know. You don't know. And so I find that really compelling, that these two men ultimately want to prove their names. It's just that Mitch is going about it in a way that is not upstanding, you know what I mean? And it comes back to haunt him. But it's a beautiful moment at the end for him. You know, Ian just goes to jail. Like, okay, cool. Ian just goes to jail. It's funny. It's hilarious the way that they trick him. But Mitch, when he takes that step, you know, to say, okay, now I've got to save you, but please give me credit. Like, give my family credit. In his final breaths, he at least comes around and realizes that the most important thing is the family legacy, not getting the money of the city of gold. And so, I don't know. I find that more interesting.
Yeah, well, and I think we're meant to. I think the ability to expand everything about the second movie includes expanding our villain or our antagonist at this point in the franchise. I think the other thing is that one thing that they both have in common is that they show off how much smarter that Ben is at this stuff than they are. Like, both of them are on his coattails, and both of them essentially allow him to solve the puzzles, and they just come in and then brute force their way into the next step. I was even talking to my son about this. We were watching the first one, and I said, when we look at the way that Ben and Riley plan to steal the Declaration, and you compare that to how Ian does it, like, there's brute force and then there's strategicness. And I think that's the first of probably several different moments in both movies that we see how crafty Ben is, like, how he's thinking, how he understands things. And both these characters use that. They never do things on their own. But while I'll give an extra point to Mitch, is the ability to clone a phone. Like, he is still doing the same thing. Like, he's following Ben, but he's using technology to do it. You know, we're 3 years later, we're into the flip phone era, and the camera pictures are terrible. So awesome. But the gadgetry, I think, So I think we're tied. Yeah. Best use of best motive. I think we're even there. They both get a point. But I think when it comes to like the gadgetry in the movies, I think that because of the amount of things that they have to interact with in the second movie with the desks and the phones and all this stuff, I'm going to give a point to the second one because the declaration, again, is the thing and the glasses are cool. But I think that because they have to do so many other different things, including turning giant wheels and working aqueducts and things like that, I think the second movie really plays into let's give them gadgets. Let's give them things that they have to do. Let's unchart the crap out of this. Because I was like, when's Nathan going to show up and help them like jump across pillars in a specific order? Like I was really wanting that, man. This is just so good. And I think that the second movie just handles that so well.
Yeah. I mean, the two parts of the desk, the sneaking into the White House, the Oval Office, and sneaking into the Buckingham Palace and the aqueduct part or whatever underground, like those, the cistern, whatever you want to call it, those are definitely Uncharted-esque vibes. The tech gives me much more of a, like, I still go to the Mission Impossible. That's all I could think of was I was like, Mission Impossible was in its heyday. It had come back after the first movie, and now they were like, okay, we're going to do a franchise, and we're going to, like, start pumping these out after 2 and 3. And I was like, that's what this feels like it's trying to ape off of, with the remote-controlled helicopter on the Statue of Liberty with cameras. And, I mean, it's just, you're right. There's so much more tech. I do really enjoy the basicness of National Treasure, though, and like I think it's really clever how they lift the fingerprint to get in order to like actually have Abigail's fingerprint so they can get in to get the Declaration of Independence. And I like the ways in which they very carefully have to like, you know, mess with the document in order to make invisible words appear. And I do like those little glasses. So I mean, it's I agree with you. More tech is definitely Book of Secrets. I prefer the basicness of the first movie from a just watching it standpoint. Like I'm slightly more invested in the simplicity of just everything about it because I actually like that it's confined in America and it's very like it's Philly, it's Washington. Like we're not going very far. And that works really well for me, but you're right. It is.
Yeah.
There's some cool ideas that get you, the cloning of the cell phones, particularly, I thought was really interesting to see. And also another, you know, feather in the cap of like why Mitch initially is not trying to kill and murder. He is trying to follow and just let Gates solve the puzzles, very Uncharted, or Indiana Jones, or any adventure movie. There's always a guy who's not smart enough to do it himself, who's following around the guy who is smart enough to do it himself, and then just wants to take the credit or take the answer from him at the end and go get the reward. It's just super classic trope.
Yeah, and I love it. I love that trope. I love a lot of the tropes that are in these two movies that just make the things fun to watch. So that kind of leads in. You mentioned something about traveling around Philly and going all these places. All right. Travelogue. And I call it, you know, best travelogue because, you know, we're just going to places. I at first had the obvious choice of Book of Secrets because they go everywhere. They go to Paris. They go back to Mount Rushmore. I don't know that they go to, I forget what other cities they go to, but I think that's the London. So yeah, for the Buckingham Palace. All great. However, I think that one of the poignant things about these two movies is that we get sort of a history lesson. We get to understand, even if it's fake, even if it's conspiratorial, we get a little bit of history. Like, I didn't know that there were actually 3 Statues of Liberty before watching this movie. I actually thought there were just 2, and there's like a third one that I didn't even know about. And then we get the Resolute desks. Didn't know that there were 2 of those. I didn't know that there was a door that was created for Roosevelt, you know, to hide his handicap, you know.
Is that true? I never know what's true.
I don't
and
know,
what's not.
But okay. I'm choosing to believe it, okay? This is not a biopic, so I'm just going to believe.
Is there really a secret tunnel in Mount Vernon that like...
I mean, yeah, let's just call that a win. And so I think there's so much, there's so because the history is so very defined in the first one, I have difficulty saying I didn't not enjoy going to these different like national monuments and things. But by a nose, I'm gonna still go with Book of Secrets, because I love the fact that we got international, that we got connection points, that Paris has a Statue of Liberty, and so we got to go to Paris, that the Resolute Desk exists in the Buckingham Palace, so we got to go to London. It's not just the distance, but it's the connection back to American history that I think takes that for me as being the better of the, I say better, the more enjoyable of the two. So what about you? What's your take?
I probably would go with the same line of thinking as you. I like the deeper, man, I don't, no, I wouldn't. I'm not going to just give in. I like the simplicity. I like the confined nature of visiting multiple places in Washington, D.C. and really feeling like I'm in Washington, D.C., seeing characters on the mall and the White House and the Oval, and not in the Oval Office, but you see, you know, the White House, the Capitol, they're in wherever the Declaration of Independence is. Don't ask me. And then they go to Philly, right? And so you get to see mm-hmm. that the Liberty Bell is there and kind of bounce around in the city there. I'm going to switch it. I do think there's just more. There's more in right. Book of Secrets. They go more places. And so I guess I would say this. It's not the Paris and the Buckingham Palace sections that do it for me. It's actually the Mount Vernon and the fact that they go to the Library of Congress.
Okay.
And the Mount Rushmore. The fact that this thing is like under Mount Rushmore is insane. And first of all, the way they find it, the whole clue to find like the eagle by putting water out in the sun and then the eagle appears. Those are the things that I love this genre. Like you and I both like treasure hunting movies. One of our favorite things. But this is the suspend disbelief part of this genre where I'm like, come on, man. Like that is not what it works like. But you know, you reach into this hole and you pull a lever and then this door opens up and now you're under Mount Rushmore and there's a city of gold. Like, I'll give it to Book of Secrets by a hair.
Okay.
With you. I'll go with you.
Fair enough. And I don't disagree. I love the absurdity of some of these moments. Like it's just, and I think it's great because there's very much a little tongue in cheekness there. I don't think they ever made any commentary about how absurd this was, but I mean, especially with the, when they find the book, I like how they lean into the conspiracy theories that live on American soil and how Riley gets validated of all the stuff that he writes in his book when he sees, oh, Area 51, which I think is great because that's such an, I mean, it's very dated because we now know that the government has officially, you know, not, they're not denying Area 51. Like they acknowledge its existence, not necessarily what goes on there. But I think for me, I totally agree with you. And by the way, I just want to ask this one question. Never been to the Library of Congress, have been to Washington, D.C. Fantastic. Everybody needs to go there at least once if you're an American. It's such a fantastic, spend a week there, go to the museums, walk the mall. It's fantastic. And I'm not even like a patriotic dude, but it was just fantastic. Went there senior year of high school for a choir mission trip. Yeah. Anyway, but riddle me this. When they're in the Library of Congress and they're trying to escape Mitch and his people, they go into like this tunnel thing, like in the middle of the library. I don't know if you, that was like kind of cool. Like there's just like, almost like there's this escape room, like a door where they go down there. Like, I didn't know that existed. So I thought just for realistic purposes, that's kind of a cool thing. I'd like to go to the Library of Congress just to check that out. That was neat. I loved it, that use right there.
I agree. I thought that that was really cool. I mean, those are actually the parts that I find more interesting than the, like, using a remote control helicopter with a camera on it. That's what makes this national treasure, is going down the Library of Congress, you know, staircase or whatever. It's the Mount Vernon sequence underneath Mount Vernon through this like tunnel that exists. It's having the visualization. I absolutely love that scene in the first movie where they're explaining how the Declaration of Independence is protected and you're watching it happen, and you're seeing like how this case like retracts down into this vault. Like, it's so sick to me. I'm getting like, that's the heist movie part coming out too. You're just like, absolutely. Ocean's 11. You're explaining
the explanation. Yeah, you know, explanation. Right, here's how we're gonna do it. I love it.
I just love all that stuff. And you know, when it's tied to historical things, I think it just amps up the interest level for most viewers, because there's a, I don't know, there's like a, when you most heist stuff, it's something you never would believe real people could necessarily do, or it's, I don't know, there's a fantastical element about it, whereas for some reason when we're dealing with these historical locations and these historical documents and artifacts, it kind of feels more attainable. Like, and he's just a dude. Like, they're just they're just people. Riley's your great comedic relief guy in the chair, like you said. To me, he is like pre-MCU quippy everything, but I love it. And but these are just absolutely average human beings, other than their knowledge, and they're able to succeed in what they need to accomplish through extraordinary will. And that is sometimes more interesting than having a supreme like technical skill, or, you know, being able to shoot a gun really well.
Right. And I think that the use of the crew in this movie, in both these movies, is really well done. It's very difficult when you create a sequel, and the Ocean's franchise, I think, does this pretty good as well. When you expand the crew, I mean, that's a lot of people in that movie, by the way. So I like a small crew. This is fine. You know, keep my family, mi familia. I'm good with Dom, you know, and yeah, give me the five. I'm good. But this movie expands just enough to make sense. So Ben, Riley, Abigail, we got the trilogy of people here, the triangle or whatever. And they all have a particular set of skills. Like, Ben is the smart guy. Riley's the levity and also the explainer for the audience. And then you have Abigail, who is a great foil in the first movie because she's the one that needs convincing. And then when she gets that convincing, then she's all in. And I think the three of them adding in Patrick Gates, it's fantastic. I love the dynamic of all these folks because it doesn't feel like anyone is shoehorned. And then when you bring in Helen Mirren in the second movie, it doesn't feel like you're just adding people to add, and they all bring something to the table, at the very least for the entertainment of the audience. Like, I love, like you, I'm going to be a Riley fan. My favorite line is when they're in Urban Outfitters and he has that aha moment about daylight savings time. And this would be me. Like, I would be sitting there with Ben Gates being like, wow, yeah, let me just sit here and revel in this moment. Is this what it feels like to be up here? Yeah, this, I love his sarcasm, and I love the struggle that he has throughout the movie to feel validated. Second movie, he gets a car, he gets a book, and yet neither of them give him any kind of street cred until the very end. And I love his little redemption arc. I think it's great. But I absolutely adore Patrick Gates and his ex-wife. Like, I just adore them together. Because you can see how, like, they are just cooperative. They're great companions. And there was a rift, and much like with Ben and Abigail. And I think those are great pairings to see. And it never felt like there was an eyesore with either couple. They all felt like they were necessary and moments important. We got enough of all these characters to feel like they rounded out this crew up that was necessary for both movies in their own rights.
Oh, 100% agree. And I think it's all to do with understanding pacing and understanding restraint. We never get too much of them together at once. We have maybe three or before the climax where they're stuck together underground. I think we have two scenes of them together. One where they initially go meet her, and there's some fun banter back and forth. And then the second one, when Mitch is also there and she has to lie, or she has to kind of deal with that situation while Mitch is hiding behind the door or whatever. But so it's a little over 2 hours. barely over 2 hour movie. And that tells, I mean, that is part of it. It's not 2.5 hours. We're not spending an extra 20 minutes digging into the history of Patrick and Emily because we need to establish something and make them bigger than they need to be. They are perfectly accentuated, like supporting cast members. And I love what you said, because the thing about Riley, the arc Riley has is so good, especially for someone who is largely comedic. But just especially in the second movie, the way that it plays off of everything from the very beginning with the book signing and how it twists that at the end of the movie for somebody who comes up to him and she's like, hey, are you right? And, you know, did you write this book? He's like, yeah, but you don't want the other guy. And she's like, no, I want you. You know, and then, of course, you get the fun comedy beat of he got the Ferrari sent to him by the president. But then he runs into something. But I love the moment where he does get his comeuppance for a second. And he's like, Ben, you didn't read the book. He's like, if you would read it's in my book. Like, I have the knowledge. He finally has a piece of knowledge that they don't. Not just right. A skill, but he has a knowledge that they do not attain yet. And I love how he says, Ben, if it was you trying to convince me, you'd have less evidence and I'd already believe you. And I guess one of my absolute favorite lines in the whole movie, because I'm like, that is camaraderie. And that shows you these guys are best friends. Like, Riley is going to ride or die with him. And he shows Ben that, like, he is worthy of, like, having a little bit of that respect back right there. And I think it's a great moment. And they don't overdo it. It's understated. It's perfect.
Understated, I think, is the best way to describe their relationship and Riley specifically. And it starts just early on. I mean, after the whole fiasco with Ian and the Charlotte, where they go and we meet Abigail, who I just think is great. You know, she's got that slight German accent because the actress is German, so it sort of comes out. And so she's sort of playing herself in terms of, like, how they recognize the accent. But I love how when they're explaining to her about the invisible map that gets them to buried treasure, Riley's like, and that's when we lost the FBI. And that's when we lost the Department of Homeland Security. Like, he never freaks out.
So funny.
Everything is just understated. Like, even when when Mitch or Ben is going up to talk to her at the party, Riley's like, is that hot girl? Like, it's just, it's very, like, buddy, little brother, not annoying, but just very matter of fact. And I think that's what makes him so great, because you've got Nick Cage, who can be understated and then just kind of explode. Like, he does that in Gone in 60 Seconds, where he can be very subtle and then he'll rage a little bit. Like, he did that in the first movie, or maybe it was the second movie, where he just freaks out for a minute and his dad's like, calm down. He's like, sorry. But I think Riley acts as a great counterpoint to Ben. And you're absolutely right, because Ben says after that, he goes, good work, Riley. Like, solid work. Like, he validates him. And I think we feel that way about Riley already, not just that he's a punching bag or a departmental, like, humor guy for our own laughter. Like, I want to read his book. I want to read what kind of theories he has, even if none of them are true. I think that he's got, in fact, my son was like, where can I get that book? And I said, I don't know. Maybe it's somewhere on the internet. But he's great. And I think that I love that he gets the girl at the end, or a girl at that point, at the very least, and a Ferrari, tax-free.
Well, they never treat him, like you just said, like, they never treat him like a punching bag fully. He's funny, but it's all in a tongue-in-cheek way. And so we never dislike Ben Gates because he mistreats Riley. That's never the case.
Right.
That's why it works so well. It's not like Ben Gates needs to recognize this major character flaw. It's a slight thing, right? And so it's beautiful when they come together and kind of, like, have that understanding exist between them. Yeah, there's that funny line about that in the beginning when he's talking about the taxes, and he says, do you know what taxes on $5 million are, Ben? $6 million.
Even the way he describes his, like, my accountant yes. set up a company in and the said that Bahamas.
An offshore, he said on an offshore island. And he's like, that's how everybody does it.
that's how business is done.
I was like, Riley, come on, man. You're smarter than that. You can hack into a police database to get a picture of something that was taken on a speed camera. So dumb. That's so unbelievable, by the way.
I know.
At least it's unbelievable in 2006 or whatever. But these days, you know, super HD, it probably could be done, but...
Well, and I think that says something, you know, for better or for worse, like if this is aging the best. These are definitely, in some ways, capsuled movies because of the use of tech, like the flip phones and the kind of Mission Impossible-esque unbelievableness of how they get things done. Like, nobody in their right mind is going to let Ben and Abigail walk through Buckingham Palace with flowers and not question what they're doing. But it makes for good movie theater, like, entertainment. And I'm okay with it. I'm there for that kind of stuff.
It's also one of my favorite jokes in the whole movie is when that all goes down and Riley is, you know, in the background because he's back there doing the tech thing, running right. the show. And he goes, and you hear them say, the fire alarm's going off. And Riley goes, uh-oh, God save the queen. Just like, you're such a dork and I love you.
But even, like, I love watching him set up his tech. Like, one's like an old iPod, but at the time it probably wasn't old.
There was an iPod, and I wrote it down. There was something else. There was a BlackBerry was up there too. It was multiple different kinds of devices.
Yeah, like there's no prejudice to tech here. Like, we're not using just Apple devices. We're gonna go BlackBerry. Maybe there's an Android. There's a Razer.
Razer. And they didn't overdo it. Again, understated. Right. They didn't try to show us on the BlackBerry how he hacked it because they knew that is ridiculous. They just threw the devices up on the wall all slapped together with Velcro. Exactly. With
Velcro and like
ridiculous.
Like AV cables coming
out. Yeah, I know.
So good, man. He would be, I mean, he's my guy in the chair. I would trust him any day with tech. Ancient or not. Okay, one more question and then we can finish off with some just miscellaneous stuff. Okay, so we've got these two treasures. And when I say treasures, I don't mean the Declaration of Independence because that was the means to the end. We're talking about the buried treasure using the Declaration along with glasses and stuff. The City of Gold. Which one, in your opinion, was the hardest to actually get in terms of treasure?
Oh, I mean, unquestionably the second one, in my opinion. Okay. There's way more booby traps. I actually wrote down how I would not make it ever in one of these movies. Like, there's just no way that I would survive. I don't have the balance to stay on a beam. I don't have the math skills to, like, even it out. I don't have the jumping skills to even leap to, like, or the strength to leap and grab some sort of a ladder. I just don't have. I'm claustrophobic. I hate heights. Like, I would not survive. I wouldn't make it out. It's that simple. And so I love movies like this where everyday people are just barely getting by the skin of their teeth, and and it's Uncharted. I mean, it's the first one was cool, but it was, again, it was like almost like a dry run set wise for what they clearly got a bigger budget to do, mm-hmm. and the bigger budget is more fun and more expansive and took a little bit longer.
Yeah. I think they took a page out of The Last Crusade. I think one of my favorite parts of Last Crusade is clearly the gadgetry and the getting to the Grail. I think that's probably the best sets of scenes in movie history because we get the heist, treasure hunt, puzzle all at once. And that's what I think is great about Book of Secrets is that there is a combination of intelligence and strength, agility, like all the stuff, again, from a regular crew of people to do what they need to do. And I also love the fact that when they're underground, the level of believability is pretty high, depending on who's doing what. So you have Ben, Riley, Abigail, and Mitch, who are on that platform. I don't know that Patrick and his wife would be able to do that. I mean, not that being old prevents you from that, but I think that their way of getting to the City of Gold made sense. Like that they slid down and they were, you know, they didn't have to lift heavy boulders or shift things around. I mean, that was left to folks that were younger and able to do that. But they all had their own version of peril, and I thought that was fantastic. I also want to point out, I love the way that we get the kidnapping scene. I think Bruce Greenwood's great as the president. I always, at some point, I would love to just maybe write a blog about the best movie presidents in history. I mean, he's up there, and he doesn't do much. I think his charisma and the way that he and Ben interact, I would love to see a spinoff or some extension of this where he's the president, because he has such great charisma and he feels approachable. So when they're the fact that Ben could convince him to go down into the bellows or whatever of the house to get kidnapped, I think speaks volumes about how he wants that sense of adventure. And I think that's fantastic coming from a president.
Exactly. He was excited about it. And I was like, I want a president like this, right? I want someone who would be not worried about his safety first and foremost, but would be interested in learning and the ideas and what was going on. And you're right. He also just, man, he's just phenomenal. Like I love him too. And I think it is, he doesn't have enough to do to be like one of the greatest, considered the yeah. greatest movie Agreed. Presidents, but for his like pound for pound kind of per minute screen time is just absolute fire. Everything he says is perfect. Like, where else do you keep a book? The Library of Congress, right? And just everything, the casual way, and he's like, page 47, just have a look at that. Do something for me, but, you know, page 47, just have a look at that. I don't know, everything. And then, and when he says, I love that both movies, both him and Harvey Keitel's awesome in this too, in a very, yeah. you know, limited role as the FBI agent who he forms a relationship with. Both of them say very similar things to him about basically somebody's got to go to prison, Ben. I love that those sequences, both of them. The president's like, I can't tell them the truth and you kidnap the president. So good luck. And then Harvey Keitel has that moment where he's like, it's like, can I take the option where somebody doesn't go to prison? Somebody's got to go to prison, Ben. I just thought that they both handled that really well. But yeah, Bruce Greenwood is just freaking fantastic.
Well, I mean, and I know him from several things, one of which is, you know, Star Trek as Captain Pike. And he exudes leadership. Like, I think
also
that's
not
what...
long enough for my liking.
I
we don't
know,
get him
right?
long enough.
It's so frustrating.
He gets these like great moments and then we just shuffle him off.
Maybe he has some television under his belt that we could check out. I don't know. Put it on AOS if it's a limited series. Anyway. Well, I think that for me, I wanted to hit on those things. What do you have that you want to talk about?
I just want to shout out something that makes the first movie awesome that I don't normally talk about, like filmmaking. But for some reason, I specifically noted this, and I noticed it once, and then I saw it reoccurring over and over and over. And this does not carry on in the second film. I did not feel this way. That's part of why the first film still stands a little bit above for me. But there is just a brilliance in the editing in this movie, in the way that they build suspense for an otherwise pretty low stakes kind of story, adventure story at times. And there's three specific examples I wrote down. One is when Ben is retrieving the glasses from the Liberty Bell area, the tower. He gets off on the roof and he goes over that little brick and he pulls it out. And we see Abigail and Riley up in the bell tower. Simultaneously, we cut back and forth to Ian looking at the bell tower, realizing that's where he needs to go, and approaching. And we cut to Ben working the brick out, getting the glasses, Ian climbing the stairs, Ian getting up to the stairs, Abigail and Riley aren't there, and he rushes and he looks over the rail, and everything is edited in a way to make us believe Ben should be down there. But then we cut, and Ben and Abigail and Riley are, in real time, actually have been gone for like 10 minutes. They're running away. Brilliant sequence. Then they do it again, something like this. Abigail in the market, when she is hiding from Ian. It's after she jumps behind the meat counter and the lady's like, you can't be here. And she's like, I'm trying to get away from my ex-husband. And
honey, you stay as long as you need.
Honey, you stay as long. She's like, I see why you left him. But she gets, when she, it's after that happens, right? And we know that Riley is also coming to find her. But we keep seeing Abigail and we keep seeing the bad guy. And we see Abigail from behind the camera view. And someone is approaching her and reaches out to grab her shoulder. And it's edited and the music and everything has made us, leads us to believe it is the bad guy. And then she turns around and it's Riley. But then the camera flashes and boom, there is the guy. He is there and he sees them. And we're back in the chase. And I love that. And then there's another one more time. It's on the aircraft carrier. The bad guy on the aircraft carrier is the same goon. We get a shot of him lining up Ben Gates from afar. And he has a gun. And he pulls it out and he aims and he gets him in sights in the film. I mean, everything is leading you to believe he is about to shoot and assassinate Ben Gates, right? Like, he got him out in the open, there's a distraction, and then the editing cuts to him pulling the trigger, but he holds it, and then it cuts to a screen and shows you that it's a signal scrambler. It's not a firearm. And I just, those are three examples, and I was like, it just kept happening and happening and happening. I was like, man, the way they build suspense in this movie is so clever and so well done that you don't have to have an actual bullet going off all the time or an actual fist fight because you are evoking those same stakes and fear in the audience without it. I don't know. I just, for some reason, I noticed it.
No, that's great because I think it speaks to what heist movies have in their DNA, and that's deflection. Not only deflection of main characters to their antagonist counterparts, but also for us as an audience. And I think you're speaking to that at least indirectly when it comes to kind of thwarting our expectations as an audience, where it's not so straightforward. The movie Now You See Me is so great at this because it's a movie about magic and it's a movie that has to be that kind of deceptive with its audience, with its protagonist, with its antagonist. And I think that's why it's one of our favorites too. Not only because Mark Ruffalo's in it, he's awesome, and Jesse Eisenberg, but the fact that you have that kind of deflection. Heist movies have to have deflection because they have to leave the bad guys wondering what's going to happen next, and the audience as well. Both these movies have that, but I absolutely agree. I think the first one has it more because it's so compact and because the story's a lot simpler. Like, when you expand a story and make it more complex, the deception has to be a little bit more, sometimes a lot more complicated, because you already know the beats, you already know the rhythm. And I think that that's what the first movie has going for it. It's not that we don't know what's going to happen next, but we make assumptions as an audience and then we get thwarted in a good way. I absolutely love that scene because Ben, and again, I got kind of played too. Ben jumps in the water, the escape's great, he gets the scuba diving mouthpiece, and then he pops up to one of Ian's goons saying, "Welcome to New Jersey." So the rest of the movie takes place in New Jersey, but we find out that Abigail and Riley have actually turned the tables on Ian and his crew, but not completely. So it's a back and forth chess game between these two individuals. Like, oh, well, I have to have an extra card in my hand, says Ian. And so he brings out Patrick, who he's got things. And then Patrick makes that great comment like, hey, we got to keep the status quo until it has to change. And then we have to move. And it's from the moment of the escape and getting to New Jersey that we don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I never thought that these characters were going to die necessarily, but we wondered when and what was going to happen. And again, it led to that great moment when they're down in the cave and Ben, maybe he's acting, maybe he really does believe what he believes, but he's like, yeah, this is it. Maybe it was taken. And then Patrick gives that great thing about Boston.
And I completely fell for it. Again, I've seen the movie every time. Every time I've seen it so many times, and I still believe every time he does it, I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot the treasure's not here, and then they go find it anyway every time. It's like, ah, that was so brilliant.
But even then, Aaron, it was like after they got Ian to leave, they go into that next room, and then they're like, ah, I thought it would be here, and they have their own sad moment of like, I guess it was stolen. But then they get validated, and it's like, listen, I think that there's a great moment between Patrick and Ben where he says, look, we're standing in the room where the treasure was. It exists, Ben. The place exists. I believe you. You did good. And then we get the payoff with Charlotte. The secret lies with Charlotte. The whole bookend right around to the very end where it starts and ends with this great pipe that serves as a key. And then the thing. And then we get the treasure room. I think for my money, just from an organic standpoint, the reveal. So I guess that'd be another, you know, category. The reveal of the treasure, the first one takes it for me. Even though I think the reveal in the second one's kind of cool with the water and the city of gold or whatever, that just seems a little too kind of on the nose. Because again, going back to what we talked about earlier, the national treasure, you've got Abigail who's like, oh my gosh, there's so much history here. Like, it's not just the gold, it's the value of what's there. And I felt that, and it felt perfectly placed inside the, you know, on American soil, you know, a part of our political history and the things that made us who we are. It felt real to me. Whereas the City of Gold felt like, oh yeah, I read about that myth growing up and that would be kind of cool. Oh, it happens to be underneath the this monument, Mount Rushmore. Okay, sure. But I'm less inclined to go hunting for that and more inclined to go digging in a church and pulling some dude's bones out who's a Mason. And then, you know, I feel like I could do that. Whereas I can't do the...
That's what I was saying. It's relatable or attainable.
Yeah. Yeah.
To just an everyday dude.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's it for me, man. Any final thoughts before we wrap up?
No, not really. I'm just very satisfied. So glad that we had a reason to rewatch these and talk about them before we took an end, because these were great.
They are favorites of my son. When I told him that we were covering these, he's like, well, I want to tune into that episode. So
that's fantastic.
The first time he's ever done that.
Hi, Carson.
Yeah.
Grow up to be the next Nathan Drake minus the gunfire. Okay.
Just well, if he has a soccer ball with him, he could be the next Nathan Drake. I don't think he'd go anywhere without a soccer
ball. That's Cassie. Didn't Cassie play soccer?
Oh, maybe, yeah.
Cassie Drake.
Okay.
Yeah, you could team up with Cassie. She's not real.
That's right. The next generation of Uncharted. So Naughty Dog, if you're listening, you know what's coming. The Adventures of Cassie Drake and Carson.
Cassie.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There we go.
They'll CC you on that. Anyway, all right. That's terrible. Okay. All right. That's going to finish up this discussion. So, as we've said before, this is our official last movie conversation, but we have one more episode coming in the next couple of weeks, more of a retrospective. So, we would love it if you tuned in and listened and heard us do whatever we're going to do. It's kind of unplanned at this point, so I'm excited to see what's coming. We hope you've enjoyed all these episodes. We hope you enjoyed the conversations. If you haven't listened to all 400, they're here. They're here for your enjoyment. It'll be good to lay this to rest, but I'm really glad that we finished with a couple of great treasure hunt heist movies to kind of finish off our conversation. So thanks for listening, everyone, and tune in a couple of weeks as we give you the final episode of Feelin' Film.